This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Mumia Abu-Jamal wins a victory in court and celebrates a legal win for sick inmates in Pennsylvania's prisons. And a police reform group wants to safeguard mentally ill people from police violence.
But first, a new year is dawning, and it's been 2 years since investigations began into the so-called Russiagate scandal. But Black Agenda Report editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly says the main charge against President Trump, WikiLeaks, and the Russian government remains unproven.
There's still no evidence of collusion between Trump and the Russian government. We have people who have pled guilty to a variety of crimes, such as Paul Manafort. He's guilty of tax fraud. Michael Cohen paid off a porn star and was involved with an unrelated matter of some taxi medallion scam in New York City. Michael Flynn did lie to the FBI about meeting the Russian ambassador. But he did so because Israel asked him to. They wanted to talk about an upcoming vote at the UN. So we have people who are involved in various levels of crookedness, but nothing tied to this charge of collusion. No proof that the Russians were Julian Assange's source in publishing the DNC emails. So they have to keep going back, using the media to spread their stories. And today, another story broke, a McClatchy papers, that allegedly some intelligence sources say that Michael Cohen was in Prague and met with Russians. Now, he keeps denying he was ever in the Czech Republic. And I recall that he had, in fact, turned over his passport to a journalist. And it's not, to make a long story short, it's not possible for him to have been there at the time that it is claimed. So they are, unfortunately, well, because the evidence shows that this claim of collusion is unproven, they have to find new ways to keep whipping up this story. And by they, I mean the Democratic Party and the corporate media and their friends in the intelligence agencies. Having started this lie, they cannot let it go. It is a way for Democrats, they think, to get votes, to keep talking about Russia. So I believe, unfortunately, every time something is disproven, it actually prolongs the story because they cannot admit that they have carried out this scam for so long.
Also, the British paper, The Guardian, carried a story that was picked up by The Washington Post that claimed that Manafort had met with Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder who's been locked up for the last 6 years in the Ecuadorian embassy in London.
Yes, and that was equally ridiculous. These people, they hope that nobody pays attention. The Guardian published the visitor logs a few months ago. Manafort never came to see Assange. I mean, it's just ludicrous on its face. Why would he? So they published these logs, which do not show Manafort visiting Assange, no Russians visiting Assange. And obviously, this location is under constant surveillance by MI6, by British intelligence. If Manafort ever went into the Ecuadorian embassy in London, there would be video proof of it. So they tried that for a short while, and fortunately, there was a lot of pushback. And they've dropped it for the moment and won't answer any questions about why they printed something which was so easily disproven. But this just shows the linkages between the corporate media and the state in the UK and here in the US. And it gives us a reason to question the acceptance of this idea that these are democratic nations. They are not. Anytime the state has that kind of influence, that kind of power over the media, you're not talking about democracy.
Even before Russiagate, the ethics of corporate journalism were quite questionable. They seem to have disappeared entirely in the past 2 years.
Yeah, Trump was not their guy. They were in the tank for Hillary Clinton. That's why they did not know that the tide was turning in Trump's direction. And Trump, of course, being who he is and being as frankly stupid as he is and his constant attacks on the press, he doesn't even realize if he made friends with them, they'd want to have access to his administration the way they do for every president. But being the person that he is, his constant attacks make it easy for them to be against him and in the corner of the Democratic Party and others in the political establishment. And this is disturbing for many reasons. First of all, they don't even hate Trump for the reasons you ought to hate Trump. I don't think they care that he's a racist. I don't think they care about that at all. They care that he will do some of the things he said when he ran for office. That's what made him suspect. When he said he wanted to have better relationships with Russia, when he called into question the trade deals, which had become the staple diet of the neoliberal class, they decided he should not be president, but he became president anyway, mostly because of their corruption, which created incompetence and allowed him to squeak through the electoral college. So we have the press trying to get a president out of office. He, of course, has made it easy for them with the things he has said and done, but he cannot win with the media. I can't recall in my lifetime any president the press have turned on presidents before, but I've never seen anything like this. But it's not because they want to do anything progressive. It's not because they want to do anything for the people.
And of course, most black folks do hate Trump for the right reasons, and he's earned their hatred. However, because of the Democratic Party's and corporate media's campaign, Trump and Putin have now been linked in the public consciousness. And we hear black folks saying things about Putin and Russians that they never said before.
Of course. Because it's easy to believe anything bad about Trump. It's partly him. It's partly his own fault bragging and lying about he did deals in Russia. He didn't do any deals in Russia. He tried to build in Moscow for more than 30 years. It was still the Soviet Union when he first started. And he was always given the brush off. The Russians treat him like he just fell off a turnip truck. But the media have excluded any other narrative. Anyone who challenges or questions this narrative is not allowed on the pages of the New York Times or the Washington Post. People who used to be able to get op-eds have been disappeared. MSNBC and CNN, it's a constant propaganda effort against Trump. Not for us, though. Not in our interest, though. So people don't hear the skepticism that they ought to have. They have not been given any reason for it. Over and over again, they hear about Russiagate, and the only counter narrative is from Trump himself mumbling about there's no collusion and it's crazy tweeting. So yes, and black people are, as we've discussed many times, stuck in this trapped in the Democratic Party. So when there's a story that broke last week, for example, which says that Russia not only used social media memes to get votes, to discourage votes for Hillary Clinton, now they say these efforts targeted black people specifically. And of course, the evidence is as dodgy as it always is, but it has the desired effect of keeping black people in the Democratic Party fold. And we've also seen the Democrats, they're already planning for the 2020 election. They're still trying to deep six Bernie Sanders. I have some issues with him, but they constantly lie about him. They decided to promote this Beto O'Rourke. He's the flavor of the month, even though he lost the Senate race in Texas. They have manufactured some rivalry between O'Rourke and Bernie Sanders supporters. And if black people were able to look at him without interference, I think he would be the preferred candidate. But they're at it again. They're doing the same things they did in 2016, which promoted Hillary Clinton, but ultimately resulted in Trump becoming president. They have succeeded in silencing people. They have succeeded in pushing this crazy Russiagate narrative. But that may mean that they succeed in being the losers again in the 2020 election.
You were speaking earlier of Donald Trump's trip to Iraq, which follows on the heels of his announcement of his intention to pull U.S. troops out of Syria, a move that made most of the foreign policy establishment and the corporate media and just about the whole of the Democratic Party apoplectic. How dare the U.S. pull troops out of anywhere?
Yes, it's partly because Syria was Obama's war. And as we saw many times with Obama, many Democrats, didn't question anything he did. He could destroy Libya. He could do this, attempt the same thing in Syria. And he had buy-in from almost everyone in the Democratic Party. So to say that it's a good thing for U.S. troops to be taken out of Syria would call into question the Democratic Party as well. And this constant attacking of him from the right continues. It is a good thing if U.S. troops leave Syria. It's doubtful if they will all leave, if they'll be replaced by mercenaries, if Israel will fill the vacuum. It will probably not be a clean result. But Trump's impulsivity and his belief that he should make his own decisions actually led to a good conclusion. It is a good thing for U.S. troops to leave Syria or any place else. We should always be happy when U.S. troops are leaving somewhere. I think the criticism that he received led him to make this trip to Iraq. But again, being who he is, he goes to Iraq without telling the Iraqis he's going. And they're offended and now say they want to take up a vote and make America leave, but they don't really have the power to. But he, in his stupidity, gave them this in. But once again, we see the Democrats are the party of war just as much as the Republicans are. Trump often gets to a good result through some crazy way. So Erdogan, the president of Turkey, calls him up and asks him to leave, and he says, okay. He didn't tell his foreign policy team, and it's actually a good thing because they would have talked him out of it. And Mattis, known as Mad Dog Mattis, resigns. And again, liberals start crying because some right winger has left his job. Mattis is the man who carried out war crimes in Fallujah in Iraq. And when they called him Mad Dog Mattis, they were right the first time. But anyone who's anti-Trump is now in the eyes of Democrats a good and heroic person. So hopefully we will see U.S. troops leaving Syria, and he's spoken of taking troops out of Afghanistan as well. And I hope that happens too.
Of course, Democrats cloak their wars these days in humanitarian terms. And so they say it's necessary for the United States to stay in Syria in order to protect the Kurds, as if they were historical friends of the Kurds.
Yes, and, you know, in about a week, it seemed like everybody's suddenly claiming to be an expert on the Kurds and their relations with the United States. People say with certainty that Turkey is going to massacre the Kurds if the U.S. Leaves. And that's always the story. When anyone suggests that the U.S. ought to leave somewhere, we're told that someone is going to be massacred by a third party if the Americans leave, as if the presence of America protects people at all. The reality is all foreign troops should leave Syria. That country should be allowed to rebuild, working with its allies of its choosing, and only with forces in the country that the Syrian people want to have there. And, you know, all this back and forth from American liberals questioning whether that's a good thing. I don't think anybody in Syria is sad to see this war finally die down. But the United States needs to stay out of other countries, close bases, stop the interventions, and this is a good first step. Even though it's coming from Trump, we should be happy to see it happen.
The reality is that every nation that the United States touches suffers mass death. Millions in Iraq, at least 100,000 in Libya, 500,000 in Syria.
Oh, absolutely. There's still this premise that the United States is good. And even people who may have protested the Iraq war, they mostly did so out of animosity towards George Bush. It was more an anti-Republican effort than a true anti-war effort, unfortunately. Most Americans still see themselves as good, still see their military as good. And it doesn't help any that we have a media which doesn't tell us the truth. And it enables people to continue to fool themselves about the role that their country plays in the world. The best role for the United States is frankly not to have a role in the affairs of other countries. It would be better for the rest of the world, and it would be better for this country. We have a military budget. It's about 60% of the budget. And it's literally why we can't have nice things, why we have a failing infrastructure, why there is austerity. We cannot have the lives we ought to have as long as we have this live in a state that's a hegemon.
It certainly seems true that Russiagate has turned the Democratic Party decidedly to the right. When Trump announced that he was pulling troops out of Syria, not only did Democratic leadership denounce the move, but it was difficult to find a major Democrat who did not say the United States should stay in Syria.
Yeah, so that was really very funny. But that, you know, in part, it was a defense of what they've been doing and of what they have been supporting. It's partly reflexive. Nobody wants to praise Trump, even though when he does the right thing, especially in foreign policy, generally by accident. But they don't propose anything different. The Democratic Party foreign policy is pretty much the same. Wars of aggression couched in terms of being humanitarian, this assumption that the United States has a right to interfere in the affairs of other countries. So they do not want to hear about anything that would change that status quo. Even Bernie Sanders, who is supposed to be such a leftist, his foreign policy is essentially the same. He's talked about stopping the war in Yemen, and it's admirable that someone finally started talking about that, but that's just the tip of the iceberg of what the United States does to people all over the world. The United States is a danger to people in the rest of the world and to people here, and the two are connected. You cannot have this expansionist, violent state that is going to be generous and caring of its people domestically.
How does Bernie Sanders and the other progressive Democrats think they're going to pay for their social programs and environmental new deals while continuing to finance U.S. empire militarily?
Well, they haven't answered the question. You know, the Democratic Party, we're supposed to be happy that the Democrats are in control of the House of Representatives again, but Nancy Pelosi is pushing this PAYGO, this pay-as-you-go. It's a right-wing trope. You can't spend more money than you take in. Well, that freezes spending. It actually cuts spending that benefit people. The Democrats gave, when Trump asked for more money for the military, they gave it to him. They actually gave him more than what he asked for. And so none of them talk about what would have to happen to do the things they claim they want to do without cutting the military budget. It's just an impossibility. So Bernie Sanders and some of the others, they're frankly just being phony. I think they do want to reform things, but if they don't talk about that elephant in the room, it can't possibly happen.
That was Bar editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly.
If there is an anti-war faction in the Democratic Party, it's been very quiet in the wake of President Trump's decision to pull all U.S. troops out of Syria. We spoke with longtime peace activist Sarah Flounders, co-director of the International Action Center. Flounders is also active in the Hands Off Syria campaign. The Democrats are screaming to high heaven with outrage at Trump's plans for a Syria pullout.
That's certainly true. And if anything confirms that both parties are imperialist war parties and that the leadership of both parties are war criminals, it's the very statements that they're making now attacking Trump. Their whole attack is to the right of Trump. They're saying that Trump is caving in to Iran and to Russia and endangering national security, which what's national security to them is U.S. Wall Street corporate interests. So this whole idea, and it's one after the other, of Democratic leaders who and the corporate media who've been busy attacking Trump, and everyone can agree on the attacks on Trump as a racist, right-wing, misogynist, bully, anti-immigrant, racist to the core, all those reasons. But to attack what is a window dressing of attacking, of withdrawing 2,000 troops from Syria, Trump on his visit to Iraq today really showed the thinking behind it, because he told the troops there, why, we can use this base if we want to do something in Syria. Why, it's right next door to send in commandos. So that's really, it's a constant shuffling of forces in the region, which has happened again and again in Afghanistan, where the number of troops have gone up, have gone down. They get renamed, as they did in Iraq. U.S. announced a complete withdrawal from Iraq back in 2011. And they just renamed thousands of them. There are 20,000 U.S. forces in Iraq today, and they're everything from listed as consulate personnel to the base where Trump was visiting, which has 5,000 soldiers there. So the name of the game is a complete fraud, an endless shuffling around, and everyone in the ruling class is actually for this. What they're angry about is the suddenness with which this happened. And that is the problem that empire faces today. And that is everywhere they're unable to implement their plans. And their plans are being pushed back by massive resistance. So that's their real problem. And they want to blame each other for it. But it doesn't change the dynamic of what's happening on a world scale, is U.S. power is waning everywhere, and U.S. weapons are not all-powerful.
U.S. troops, 5,000 of them, are in Iraq, but that's with the permission of the Iraqi government. The United States has no legal leg to stand on in terms of occupying any part of Syria, but the subject of international law doesn't even come up with the U.S. corporate media or with most elements of the Democratic and Republican parties.
International law, in terms of U.S. power, is an irrelevancy. They never, ever even pay lip service to it. The sanctions on Iran, completely illegal. They even signed an international treaty and yet turned around and flipped it. So it's absolutely true that U.S. troops were not only not invited, Syria has demanded again and again that they leave Syria. And yet there they are staying. And by the way, the Iraqi parliament had refused to continue the status of forces agreement and had ordered the U.S. to leave back in 2011. Now, the impact of ISIS was felt even more in Iraq than in Syria. The U.S. did everything they could to help create and inflame this force, and then used it as an excuse to go back in thousands of troops into Iraq. And also that's when they used it as an excuse to try to capture or gain a foothold in Syria. And they gained that foothold in the Kurdish region, claiming to be protecting the Kurds in Syria, just as they claim to be protecting the Kurds in Iraq. And all of this is they have no interest in protecting anyone. They want in each area a base of operations, particularly in areas that are oil rich, resource rich, and strategically located.
What are your thoughts on what Trump is up to? We understand what the consistent U.S. foreign policy has been, expansion always, putting pressure on China and Russia and any other country that seems that it could wield countervailing power to the United States. But what is Trump's gambit?
The real problem that Trump was facing is that every one of the forces that they have for 8 years armed, equipped, trained, airdrop supplies to in Syria has been defeated. There's no way of getting around that. And the Syrian government, and they did invite in also Hezbollah, Iran, and Russian forces for aid and assistance because they couldn't survive the onslaught of tens of thousands of mercenary forces. But the fact is, they resisted. They resisted a complete takeover that was the U.S. plan for Syria. Syria had been on the U.S. hit list for decades, was part of the Axis of Evil of George W. Bush, was in every sanctions were imposed on Syria. They were determined to bring Syria down, and Syria resisted on every possible level. And they resisted also through stressing with the whole population the unity of a country that is a mosaic of many religious, ethnic, cultural groupings. And always stressing this is the whole Syrian people. Syrian nationalism was a real force in the struggle. It was also a military struggle, and they defeated all of these contending militias who exist by fighting with each other, depending on who's backing them, who's paying them. And everyone was in on funding, every one of the imperialists and their allies, funding all these different mercenary forces within Syria. There were groups that the U.S. funded. There were groups that the Saudis funded, and Qatar and the UAE and Israel through the back door in Golan Heights and bases in Jordan, of course, through Turkey, and so on, through France that had forces in Syria, along with the U.S., NATO forces in Syria, all taking part in bombing Syria and doing everything that they could to dismantle, to rip apart the whole country, which is what they did in Libya. They were able to bring down the Libyan government with 7 months of nonstop devastation and destruction. And they thought it would take less time in Syria. But Syria was able to get assistance from other countries and was able to organize larger population, a full mobilization against this takeover. And so the U.S. was pushed back in Syria in a big, big way, and they had no other forces to rely on except a toehold in the Kurdish Syrian region. Now, their problem there became Turkey was completely opposed to that because they're at a war with their own, the Kurdish population of Turkey, which is 10 times the size of the Syrian Kurds, and very oppressed within Turkey. So Turkey was against U.S. arming of Syrian Kurds or Iraqi Kurds and said that they would go into Syria to put down the Syrian Kurds, the YPG. Now, that left the U.S. in an untenable situation, caught between Syrian government, Iran, Russia on the one side, and Turkey, who has been for 7 decades a member of NATO, was an ally, opposing them on the other side for a little toehold. So as window dressing, they said, we're taking those troops out of Syria. Is it real? That really is not very likely. They were threatened in another way. Turkey took part in a series of international conferences with Iran and Russia. Now, that's a big departure. That's a flip for Turkey to be meeting with Iran and Russia in Geneva on arriving at a peace deal. And the U.S. and the other NATO members aren't even invited. That was a worry for them. And so there's a pullback, but it's not real. See, 2,000 troops to be withdrawn from Syria. We got to remember that the U.S. has 170,000 troops around the world outside the U.S. 170,000, at least that we know of. 40,000, they won't even tell you where the troops are, where they're based. And there's some 800 to 1,000 U.S. bases around the world outside the U.S. So this is a monstrous effort to dominate the entire world. And for there to be this level of attack from the Democratic Party shows you just how hypocritical it is, as if there's some huge departure here. They all know it's not. They know that.
You seem to be saying that Trump recognized the untenability of the U.S. position in Syria, but the Democrats and the corporate media and most of the so-called foreign policy establishment continue to refuse to understand that the United States was defeated in its Syrian gambit.
I think they're all playing politics with each other. Do the Democrats not recognize it? Would, regardless of who is in office, this is a problem that the U.S. empire faces today. They can no longer simply decide to take down a country, and that's what happens. They increasingly, and as the Israelis have found with the Palestinian struggle in Gaza, and as the Saudis have found in Yemen, which they thought would be over in a week or two, that people's resistance can be more powerful than the most advanced equipment on the planet, the most advanced death equipment on the planet. And that is something that neither the Republicans or the Democrats are willing to acknowledge. So they blame each other for mistakes in policy, but neither of them is willing to change their war on the world. And so, their willingness to fund a gigantic military budget and growing, or to redo nuclear weapons and spend $1 trillion on that.
So imperialism, U.S. imperialism, has no plan B.
They have no plan B except sell more weapons, make more war, try to destabilize more countries. There is, of course, a growing debate. They want to put much more attention against China, the encirclement of China, aircraft carriers, the missile batteries, the bases, aggressively, of course, encircling Russia. So some of these wars they went over with. There are debates among the generals as to where to focus. That's certainly true. I think there was a worry about being caught in a war where Turkey suddenly becomes an opponent. They want to keep Turkey in NATO. They were never against Turkey oppressing its own Kurdish minority, never opposed that, always sell Turkey the equipment to do that. So they're not protecting the Kurdish population in Syria or Iraq. All of this is complete, the most cynical opportunism and willingness to use one people and then another. They want to expand their wars in Africa, and they're aggressively doing that all over Africa. That means they got to create wars in order to fund troops, in order to make bases. This is a really destructive policy, and they're implementing it everywhere because it's the only trick they have left in the bag. Sell equipment, make wars, and take it from poor and working people right here. Just gut every social program here in order to pay for the wars. And Trump hasn't made any disagreement with that, nor has anyone in the Democratic Party. None of them had said, oh yeah, withdraw this and let's spend the money here in the U.S. Not one of them. Every one of them said, oh, wait a minute, you're going to make it too easy for Iran or for Russia. So they're militarists themselves. They're war criminals, every one of them.
Bernie Sanders drew up a foreign policy paper, which actually put more countries on a kind of enemies list, that is what he called autocratic regimes, without taking anybody off of the U.S. enemies list.
Yeah, what better example is there that you could possibly think of? as to just where every current within the Democratic Party is. Even those who may be more progressive on let's have promise a health care program here, but spend the money on war. Claim that you're for free tuition here, but spend it on a war. It is a completely cynical calculation being used again and again.
That's the contradiction between a social policy, which would, of course, cost a lot of money, and the military budget seems so stark that one has to question whether Democrats that propose all of these social programs really expect to get them passed, since they can't pay for them without cutting that military budget.
That is so true, Glenn. That is always their contradiction. And they're not serious about any program here in the U.S. for working people. And they're not serious about any kind of real environmental restitution for the planet. They're not about any kind of reparations for any people anywhere in the world. They are all committed to war. But they got to cover it all the time with promises. Now Trump will say, even during my election campaign, I was withdrawing the troops from Syria. And that's true. He said it in his election campaign. But no politician expects that the promises that are made during an election campaign are actually going to be honored. It's not even remembered past the day the words are said. So there is a real system that cannot deliver what's needed here, a system which is increasingly losing its economic dominance on a planetary scale, its ability to leverage the loans and the trade and the credits, can impose sanctions everywhere and demand the whole world abide by them, arrest a Chinese CEO who supposedly didn't abide by a U.S. sanction on Iran, which isn't even legal to begin with. They can try to enforce it all over the world, all of their completely illegal laws, and yet none of it will change the deteriorating position of the U.S. today. And they can't. They did not succeed, and this is, I think, what we should take heart in, the overturn in Syria. The Syrian people resisted through a call for total solidarity among all the people, a mobilization to motivate all the people to hang together, and organizing a military combative defense. Now, that's important. This is a small country against the biggest armed might, and we've seen 4 years of bombing, huge devastation, a third of the population displaced and refugees, and yet the resistance didn't end. So it's a lot to think about as we're going into a new year, that we got to be aware that there are limits to their power, and yet their destructive capacity and their lies to the whole population here, that's pretty endless.
That was Sarah Flounders of the International Action Center in New York City.
A Philadelphia judge has ruled that the nation's best known political prisoner has the right to present another appeal of his 1982 conviction and the death of a police officer. Mumia Abu-Jamal proved his contention that a prosecutor in his case who went on to become a judge unconstitutionally influenced Abu-Jamal's previous appeal, which was turned down. Meanwhile, Abu-Jamal continues to turn out award-winning journalism for Prison Radio. This week, he reports on another victory for Pennsylvania prison inmates.
Salvatore Chimenti, a Pennsylvania state prisoner, who is the named plaintiff in a civil rights suit against the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. The other two plaintiffs are David Maldonado and Daniel Levia, is suing DOC on behalf of thousands of Pennsylvania state prisoners suffering from hepatitis C and its notorious side effects. That case may have reached a powerful turning point, as both sides have reached a proposed settlement agreement. In that proposed settlement, Chiminti et al. Versus Pennsylvania DOC proposes to treat 1,500 men and women, of course, who have F2, F3, and F4 fibrosis or Medivir scores within 6 months, and an additional 1,500 hepatitis patients during the next year with powerful drugs known as DAAs, or direct-acting antiviral drugs. After 2020, 2,000 people are to be treated annually. The settlement agreement has to first be approved by the U.S. District Court in Philadelphia after a hearing in early February 2019. If the judge agrees, the go date will be July 1st, 2019. Mr. Chiminti was seeking Hep C treatment as far back as 2010, when it was determined that he suffered stage 4 cirrhosis of his liver due to the infection. He and his co-plaintiffs filed suit initially in 2015, and in 2017 filed an amended complaint. Earlier in 2018, the court declared Chiminti a class action. The Chiminti class is represented by renowned civil rights lawyer David Rudofsky and Su Ming Ye of the Pennsylvania Institutional Law Project in Philadelphia. If this proposed settlement agreement is signed into law, it will be a groundbreaking change in how the state and prisons handle hepatitis C cases. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
Millions of white people live in New York City, but you wouldn't know that if you visited the courts and jails of the city's five boroughs. The Police Reform Organizing Project, or PROP, reports that close to 9 out of 10 people facing arraignment in local courts on any given day are black or Latino. PROP Executive Director Robert Ganji says his group's new project is to change the way mentally ill people are treated in New York.
Right now, there is a problem involving someone with a severe mental illness in the community. Some concerned person, could be a relative, could be a neighbor, calls 911, and the 911 dispatcher sends a police officer. 911 is actually a unit of the police department. And all too often, the result of that encounter between the police officer and a severely mentally ill person results in harm being done to the mentally ill person. In some cases, the cops have ended up killing that person. So we are putting together an advocacy campaign to promote, put pressure on the city policymakers to have a different response, so that 911 dispatchers have at their disposal a list of mental health organizations, churches, and social service organizations around the city, in every neighborhood in the city, so that when a call comes in to 911 involving someone in psychiatric crisis in a local neighborhood, the 911 dispatcher sends a mental health professional rather than a police officer. The slogan that we're using to brand the campaign is "Save lives, not take them." It's our view, and the view of lots of other police reformers and thoughtful people in New York, that would be a much better way for the city to handle the problem of having people in psychiatric crisis in the community, and the people who are there who love the mentally ill people can't deal with it and they need help. But the help should be provided by a mental health professional, a trained person who's trained to deal with people who are in a severe mental health episode, rather than a police officer. So that's the campaign that we're going to be developing and promoting next year.
Yes, over and over again, police encounters with people who are said to have mental problems has resulted in death. And it goes back to Eleanor Bumpers and beyond. It seems that the police treat encounters with mentally challenged people as licenses to use excessive force rather than...
Well, police, I mean, there are some exceptions. There's some cops who have I don't know if you want to think about it as natural people skills and able to communicate and diffuse situations, but far too many police approach situations where they're inclined to use force to resolve a situation. They're trained to use force to resolve situations. And most people who become police officers are not looking to be social workers. They're looking to be law enforcement people. So we should use the resources at hand, mental health professionals in the city, to resolve these problems rather than use police officers. And I think another advantage of our approach and our proposed reform is that most cops we're aware of, that we've talked to, they prefer not to be involved in those kind of situations. They prefer to have a mental health professional be responsible rather than themselves.
Well, you say that police prefer to be law enforcement officers, but that seems to translate on the streets as targeting black folks and brown folks who are just going about their business.
Right. But that's also a function of policy. It's not necessarily what most police officers would want to do, but the policy that comes out of One Police Plaza, which is the headquarters for the NYPD in the city, is quota-driven broken windows policing. Broken windows policing basically targeting people in low-income communities of color who are often engaged in nefarious activities that have been virtually decriminalized in white neighborhoods in the city. And then also the NYPD uses a quota system to evaluate police officers' performance so that police officer knows that he or she has to make a certain number of arrests, give out a certain number of summonses in a given month in order to get a positive job evaluation. So that puts pressure on cops to engage in low-level arrests. Sometimes, and we know this for a fact, cops make up charges. They give out bogus tickets, they make false arrests in order to deal with the pressure on them to make their numbers.
What kind of activities are not criminal in white neighborhoods, but treated as criminal in black and brown neighborhoods?
Smoking marijuana is a major one, where the research has shown that the white people use and sell the drug in equal or greater proportions than African-American and Latino people, but 93% of the people arrested in New York City for marijuana possession are New Yorkers of color. Other offenses could be riding a bike on the sidewalk, carrying around an open alcohol container. Then there are other offenses like petty larceny, particularly in low-income neighborhoods of color. Often people are engaged in petty larceny because they have basic needs and they don't have the money to pay for them. Sometimes, and we've seen this when we go into the courts to monitor police arrest practices, that the police have arrested people who have, for example, stolen a container of orange juice from a Dunkin' Donuts or stolen a package of ham and eggs from the Pathmark in Harlem. People aren't stealing things like that to sell on the black market. They're stealing things like that because they're hungry. The city's response should be putting a priority on providing food for hungry people rather than locking them up.
The court system that you described, that prop monitors, seems to reflect a city that is 90 or 95% non-white, if you count the people who have to go before the judge.
Right. We monitor the arraignment parts in the city's criminal courts, and the arraignment parts are where everybody who's been arrested in the city are brought. Everybody who gets arrested has to be arraigned before a judge. So if you go into the arraignment parts of the five boroughs in New York City on a consistent basis, which we do at PROP with volunteers and staff members, you get a very good idea of police arrest practices. And virtually every time we go in, at least 85% of the people who've been arrested and are being arraigned are New Yorkers of color. Sometimes it's everybody. 100% of the people who are before a judge are New Yorkers of color. And the charges are often petty offenses. It could be petty larceny. It could be driving with a suspended license, possessing a marijuana cigarette. And again, these kind of offenses are not focused on in well-to-do white neighborhoods in the city.
New York City has about 900,000 citizens who are residents of public housing. And we know that the city has targeted public housing projects for its mass arrest policies, indicting and arresting as many as 100 people at these housing projects. And
that's targeting mainly black and brown boys, claiming that they're involved in gang activity and using very broad provisions of the law to indict people. And what we have found, or basically PROP itself has not investigated these arrest practices, but we're in touch with other organizations and other groups that have. And over and over and over again, what we hear is that the vast majority of young men arrested are not actually involved in any kind of serious gang activity. So it's the police and the district attorneys use gangs and gang activity as a cover for arresting, just unfortunately, arresting lots and lots of young black and brown men and boys. And once they put out the tag, these people involved in gang activity, that's a cover. And the public is frightened by the notion of there being gang activity. And the press generally buys that rationale instead of seriously looking at what is entailed in these sweeping arrest practices and these cavalier use of indictments. And when you arrest 100 to 120 people in one night, all young black and brown men, and then you claim that you have sufficient evidence to indict them for serious offenses, that on the surface is highly questionable and highly dubious kinds of activity on the part of law enforcement.
And after the arrests, we find that the investigations were largely based on Facebook, who said that they were friends with whom.
Right. Or they wore a different kind of clothing on a particular day, or their brother was involved in gang activity. You know, it's very loosely defined and applied criteria. And it is another example of the excessive use of law enforcement to deal with social problems in our city.
Many folks thought or hoped, maybe it was wishful thinking, that Mayor de Blasio was going to change all this. He was the great liberal hope.
Yeah, well, he's been a major disappointment on law enforcement issues and policing issues in the city. He's been a major disappointment in a whole variety of areas dealing with issues of justice as they apply to low-income black and brown people. But he basically bows down before whatever actions are being carried out by NYPD officers. We had a recent example in the city where there was a excessive use of force captured on video where police officers and security officers from the city social service agency tore a baby out of the hands of his mother. Again, captured on video was a gross example of excessive force, of the mishandling of the situation. And de Blasio and the NYPD gave the cops a clean bill of health. Joseph Bonillo, who's the police commissioner, even went so far as to say that the cops involved did all they could to de-escalate the situation. When we see on video that they're holding the woman down on the ground, they're waving a taser at the onlookers, and they're literally tearing the baby out of the mother's arms. And when you see that officers who engage in that kind of brutal action are not held accountable, are not sanctioned, we know that de Blasio has refused to sanction or dismiss all the officers involved in reckless actions that led directly to Eric Garner's death. This was the summer of 2014. Again, we saw on video the brutality of their actions, the excessive use of force, the cavalier way they treated Eric Garner, saying, "I can't breathe," 11 times. Those officers are still on the police force. And when de Blasio and the leadership of the NYPD refuse to sanction cops who have very publicly on video engaged in excessive force or engaged in brutality, that sends a message to cops that you could be guilty of virtually any kind of misconduct or excessive force and not be sanctioned. And it sends a message to the community that black and brown lives, in fact, do not matter to the leadership of the city.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.